Today is Thursday, January 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Jason Patinkin. Coming up, a look at allegations that U.S. military leaders and diplomats misled the government about the war in Afghanistan.
That gets reported up the chain, and before you know it, the president is talking about a success that doesn't exist. And I think that's a good issue to look at, not whether there was lying, but why.
Also ahead, what's next in the impeachment case against U.S. President Donald Trump? It's all on today's International Edition.
Our top story today, the U.S. Senate on Thursday takes control of the impeachment case against President Donald Trump. Democrats from the House of Representatives Wednesday night carried the formal articles of impeachment to the Senate, setting the stage for only the third trial to remove a president in American history. Just a few hours ago, the federal government's watchdog agency said the White House violated the law when it withheld military aid to Ukraine, which is at the heart of the impeachment case. The president Wednesday night said the case was a, quote, hoax, even as fresh details emerged about his efforts in Ukraine. The Senate transforms itself into an impeachment court Thursday, even as Republicans, who control the chamber, the White House, and Democrats, argue over the process. A bit earlier, I spoke with Stephen Farnsworth, political science professor at University of Mary Washington, near Washington, about what comes next.
The next few days will involve working through some of the questions of procedure. What format will this impeachment process take shape? The actual arguments themselves will take place probably on Tuesday of the next week, the 21st. And from then on, you can expect probably in the range of a couple of weeks of conversation where the senators have to sit quietly and listen to the arguments for and against the impeachment. And then after that or along the way, individual motions may take place that may totally change this process from where it started.
Now, looking into the procedures that will be discussed in the next few days, one of the sticking points is about witnesses, who will be called, how that will happen. What should we expect to see in that regard?
Well, it's clear that the Democrats want witnesses, but the Republicans are in the majority in the Senate, and so unless the Democrats can convince a handful of Republicans to go along with the call for more witnesses, the conversation could be as abbreviated as just simply hearing the case by the Democratic House managers and the president's defense team, and no witnesses at all. The pressure for witnesses has been the reason why Nancy Pelosi has held off moving the articles of impeachment to the Senate until this week. But the truth is that as long as there's a majority of Republicans who say no witnesses, there will be no witnesses.
Now, why wouldn't there be witnesses? Generally, in most trials, witnesses are a key feature.
Well, the Republicans are looking at this because impeachment is more a political process than a legal one. The Republicans are looking at this from the point of view of how do they protect their own interests as part of the calculation here. And so when you're looking at the more conversation about what Donald Trump did, that's probably not helpful to Donald Trump. And so if you look at what the White House wants right now, they want a very abbreviated trial. They would love to have this as short as possible, maybe even less than the 2 weeks tentatively looking to be the plan, but certainly not witnesses. And if witnesses are called, well, then it could become a free-for-all very rapidly, because there are some Republicans who say that if they're going to be witnesses, then, you know, maybe Joe Biden, the presidential candidate, his son Hunter Biden, might be part of the witness list. And so it could move very quickly away from what President Trump did do or did not do, and that could be a problem. What's clear for the Republicans, though, is that the support for Donald Trump among Republicans, it remains very high. And so any Republican who wants to side with the Democrats may face significant pushback from Republican voters and from their reelection prospects.
Now, there have been two different updates in the last day or so on the Ukraine case. The Government Accountability Office has said that there was a violation of the law in holding up the assistance to Ukraine. Will that statement potentially impact the Senate trial?
Well, it's part of the evidence that the House managers will likely include in their presentation of evidence for why Donald Trump should be removed from office. It'll be part of the conversation, but how seriously it is taken depends on the individual senators themselves as they look at the evidence and decide what matters to them and what doesn't. I think the key guide to how this story ends can be seen in public approval numbers. As long as President Trump's approval ratings are on the high side of 35, and he's never been much below 40, he should be okay. President Trump has had very, very fixed public opinion numbers, and the deep reservoir of support he has among Republicans really creates a very, very secure position, because in order for President Trump to be removed from office, two-thirds of the senators, that is close to 20 Republicans, would have to agree that he should not serve as president. And that seems very, very unlikely unless President Trump's approval rating becomes really, really negative. And then the senators might very well think that Trump is more trouble than he's worth.
Great. Thank you so much, Stephen, for coming on our show today.
Oh, sure thing. Have a good one.
That was Stephen Farnsworth, political science professor at University of Mary Washington.
Ukraine's government says it has opened a criminal investigation into actions by an associate of President Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani. The actions were revealed in a series of records released by the lawyer of Lev Parnas. The U.S. businessman, who is now under indictment for election campaign violations, also spoke about his allegations on television news shows Wednesday. Sagar Magani with the Associated Press has more on that story.
That comes 2 days after Democrats released documents showing Lev Parnas, an associate of personal Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani, communicated about removing Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. Ukraine's Interior Ministry says while it's not interfering in American political affairs, there may have been violations of Ukrainian law, and it's suggesting the FBI take part in the probe. Separately, Parnas told MSNBC President Trump was directly involved in efforts to pressure Ukraine into investigating Joe Biden. If true, that would undercut a key GOP defense of the president during the impeachment push, that his withholding of military aid to Ukraine was not a quid pro quo for investigating Biden. Sagar Magani at the White House.
A top Pentagon watchdog has told U.S. lawmakers there was a, quote, incentive, end quote, for U.S. officials and military commanders to lie about the progress of America's war in Afghanistan. John Sopko, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, testified before House lawmakers on Wednesday. His appearance comes 1 month after a bombshell report by The Washington Post claiming that officials misled the public about the war from the beginning. VOA's Jay Susama Oni has more.
Spanning nearly two decades and multiple administrations, the Afghanistan war is the longest in U.S. history. Okay. Members of Congress say there are lessons to be learned.
A lack of coordination, the misuse of funds, and insufficient training for Afghans has failed to reduce violence across the country. This is completely unacceptable.
More than 2,400 American service members have died since the U.S. and coalition partners invaded Afghanistan in 2001. The conflict has cost Washington nearly $1 trillion. John Sopko, Inspector General of an independent government watchdog created by Congress to combat waste and abuse in the U.S. reconstruction effort in Afghanistan, told the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Wednesday a persistent incentive to lie about the progress on the ground hurt U.S. efforts in Afghanistan.
You create from the bottom up an incentive because of short time frames. You're there for 6 months, 9 months, or a year to show success. That gets reported up the chain, and before you know it, the president is talking about a success that doesn't exist. And I think that's a good issue to look at, not whether there was lying, but why.
The hearing comes 1 month after a Washington Post report that government officials misled the public about U.S. gains in Afghanistan for years and hid evidence that the war had become unwinnable. The newspaper cited Seaguard documents as evidence. But Richard Boucher, who served as Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia during the Bush administration, says there was no deliberate deception.
I think all of us tried to tell the truth in terms of what was going on in the war, the difficulties that we were facing, the difficulties of getting things done in a chaotic situation like the one in Afghanistan.
Analysts say the main objective of the war, to get rid of Al-Qaeda, was met quickly. But flaws in the U.S. strategy to prevent resurgence of extremist groups slowed efforts in the region.
The idea that if we just came up with a better plan, a better strategy, a better training program, that somehow we could create in Afghanistan the kind of government that we saw as competent, capable, and therefore of capable of winning popular support and ensuring stability. I think that was partly based on an unrealistic view of the country and the people there and how it worked.
Despite notable failures, experts say a rash exit from the region could lead to deadlier outcomes. The Trump administration has been negotiating a peace agreement with the Taliban to finally bring the war to an end. Jason Semelny, VOA News, Washington.
The Chinese government on Thursday welcomed an interim trade agreement with the United States, but cautions the two countries must still address key issues of mutual concern. U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese Vice Premier Liu He signed the deal Wednesday to resolve an 18-month-old trade dispute between the world's largest economies. Now, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said the deal is beneficial to both countries and the entire world. That agreement does not roll back tariffs the U.S. had placed on Chinese imports. U.S. negotiators say they must remain in place indefinitely to ensure China fulfills its commitment. Beijing says it wants the tariffs lifted. Now, to get more details on the agreement, we're joined by Professor Joe Paul at the University of California Hastings School of Law. He joins us now. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us, what does this agreement actually do in terms of trade between the United States and China?
Well, the agreement is really a very modest agreement. It's more of a trade truce rather than a trade treaty. The Chinese have promised that they will enforce intellectual property rights, that they won't require U.S. companies to transfer certain technology, they won't engage currency manipulation. They're going to liberalize some financial services, and probably the biggest headline is they've promised to buy up to $200 billion worth of additional exports from the U.S. That sounds impressive, except that it is subject to market conditions, which means that the Chinese will buy those exports from the U.S. if they're priced competitively, and I assume that would have happened anyway, even in the absence of an agreement. So it's not really clear how much we've done here other than to get some promises from China, and of course it will depend on China's goodwill in the future.
What does this agreement really do to address some of the long-term concerns of many Western governments about Chinese trade practices, you know, such as subsidies for state-owned businesses and forced technology transfers?
That's an excellent question. In terms of forced technology transfers, it does say that the Chinese will not require forced technology transfers. But with regard to the other main structural issues that the United States has been concerned with, things like China's subsidies, Chinese state control of the economy, Chinese engaged in cyber theft, these issues have not been addressed.
Now, Professor, lastly, how does this agreement fit in with existing trade protocols and the World Trade Organization's rules? Does it?
Well, it clearly violates international law. The World Trade Organization does not permit countries to discriminate on the basis of nationality. The commitments that China has made are not consistent with the commitments they've made under the WTO and undoubtedly will leave them exposed to some sort of legal action brought by the Europeans. In addition, it's a really bad precedent. The United States has always been in favor of market capitalism, of allowing the market to operate. In this case, we are actually strengthening Chinese state control over the economy by having the Chinese state pledge to buy more U.S. exports. And, of course, it leaves in place 25% tariffs on $250 billion worth of Chinese imports to the United States, taxes which are being paid by U.S. consumers. It also leaves in place all of the Chinese tariffs on U.S. imports to China. So we have here a situation in which both consumers in China and consumers in the United States will continue to be hurt. It creates a terrible precedent in terms of international trade agreements, and it violates the WTO.
Well, we're certainly going to see how all of this plays out. Professor Joe Paul from the University of California Hastings School of Law, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Harry Harris, the U.S. ambassador to South Korea, says Washington has softened its demand for how much Seoul should pay for the U.S. military presence there, but he says a gap still remains. For the second consecutive year, U.S. and South Korean negotiators were unable to reach an agreement before the cost-sharing deal expired at the end of the year. Both sides hope to reach a deal that would retroactively cover the intervening weeks. VOA Seoul correspondent William Gallo attended the ambassador's meeting with foreign journalists Thursday. A few hours ago, he spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson about the ambassador's comments.
Well, there have been six rounds of talks between the United States and South Korea on these military cost-sharing issues over the last several weeks, and the latest round ended Wednesday in D.C. with no deal. There was no breakthrough. Both sides said progress was made, but that gaps remain. They don't want to talk about details, but it's quite clear that there are still quite wide gaps. The U.S. was reportedly demanding that South Korea pay five times the amount it's currently paying to support the U.S. troop presence here. South Korea officials rejected that as sort of absurd, and it offended a lot of people, actually. Your opinion polls show that this is not a very popular thing for South Korea to give in to any demand like that.
What are the implications for these talks and for getting a deal? If there's a delay, if they don't come to an agreement soon, what does that mean for the U.S. bases? What does it mean for regional security?
Well, it is perhaps dire if you talk to certain analysts, and others say not so much, as long as they eventually reach a deal. We do have some precedent here. Last year, the two sides were unable to reach a deal until February. The deal actually expires at the end of the year, so, you know, they were able to retroactively fund things. There is a certain amount of leeway that is built into the contracts every year, so it's not like things shut down at the beginning of the year. However, there is a concern, I think, not only about if this stretches past February or March or something like that, there would start to be local Korean layoffs. Donald Trump has insisted that these negotiations take place every year rather than every 5 years, which was the case for South Korea in the past. And that just puts a lot of pressure on the alliance.
Now, just as a reminder for our audience, what is the size of the U.S. presence there, U.S. military presence?
So there are about 28,500 U.S. troops here in South Korea. Now, that number fluctuates up to about maybe 31,000 or perhaps a couple thousand beneath that. But, you know, generally there's about 28,000 troops that are here. Officially, they are here to counter North Korea, but, you know, U.S. officials would not necessarily admit this, but most analysts agree that they're also there in some sense to serve as a regional force, whether that's to deal with China or other situations like that. But, there are also many troops in Japan, actually, as well, a large troop presence in Japan. And those negotiations are coming up. This would actually be 2021 where you have those cost-sharing negotiations come due. So those are sort of the next big step that could be taken here as far as U.S. Cost-sharing negotiations in the region.
All right. Now, also, the ambassador spoke about the South Korean relationship with North Korea and some proposals that the South Korean government has for that relationship. What did he have to say?
Well, South Korea over the last couple of weeks has hinted that it will resume individual tours, or will attempt to resume individual tours to North Korea. This has not been accepted by North Korea, and of course they would have to agree to this. But in the past, South Korea has allowed both individual tours and group tours to South Korea. Those were ended several years ago whenever a South Korean tourist was actually killed at one of these sites by a North Korean soldier. Now, it's not clear whether this will actually happen, but if it does, if they do attempt to move through with this attempt to allow individual tours, it could violate either U.S. or United Nations sanctions on North Korea. So the ambassador, Harry Harris, today said that if South Korea does want to do this, they want to be consulted, that South Korea should run this through a working group meant to ensure that such projects do not violate U.S. or international sanctions. And it seems at this point that South Korea would honor that based on their comments of the last few weeks.
That was William Gallo, VOA's Seoul correspondent, speaking with International Edition editor Kate Pound Dawson. VOA's International Edition continues.
The United Nations World Food Programme says a record 45 million people in the 16-nation Southern African Development Community face growing hunger following repeated drought, widespread flooding and economic disarray. Zimbabwe is among the hardest hit countries. Now, according to the UN's World Food Programme, Zimbabwe's maize harvest in 2019 was down 50% from the year before. Overall grain production was less than half of what that nation requires. The food shortage and Zimbabwe's economy, which is crippled with debt and runaway inflation, are expected to worsen this year. For more about the crisis and what might be done to stave off hunger, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Niels Bolzer, the World Food Programme's Deputy Country Director in Zimbabwe.
We are currently looking at about 7.7 million Zimbabweans, almost half of the population, that are struggling to feed themselves. But we are doubling the number that we have planned on assisting. So we're going up from 2 million to just over 4 million people during the peak of the lean season, peak being from now, January, up until around March, April. But for us to deliver at that scale, we need more than $200 million to essentially prevent millions from slipping into further desperation.
What's brought Zimbabwe to this pass?
Drought is certainly one of the key drivers. Out of the last 5 years, we only had 1 year in which Zimbabwe experienced enough rain to grow maize and other crops to the extent that they need to. One key compounding factor is we've seen inflation going through the roof over the past 6 to 9 months. So a loaf of bread, which was about a dollar 6 months ago, costs now 20 times more in the market.
Until recently, the food aid strategy among many NGOs has been simply to give cash to governments and communities so they could then buy their own food locally, thus helping local farmers. But with this terrible drought, farmers simply haven't been able to produce as much.
Yeah, I think you're making an important point here. We have seen availability of maize grain and millymeal in the markets go down over the past months quite significantly. And where you find still grain in the markets, it's for many prohibitively expensive. So that's the reason why we have moved from providing the bulk of our assistance, up to 70%, in the form of cash to in-kind distribution. A combination of maize grain or sorghum, fortified oil, as well as pulses or beans, so to say. So they have a balanced diet.
How does the food aid distribution actually work?
So we have a network of local and international non-governmental organizations that we work with spread all over the country. We procure as much as possible locally. We will look at regional markets, but also the regional markets have had its challenges because of the drought. So we have to go these days as far as Mexico, Ukraine, and other places where we source the commodities. And as you can imagine, there's quite a bit of lead time involved. But once it's in the country, we have a solid community-based targeting mechanism in place where we register the most vulnerable in those communities, and we work through our NGO partners and through the private sector providing transportation from the warehouses to those most in need.
Unless
the World Food Programme's Niels Bolzer there speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips.
You have been listening to the Voice of America's International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Jackson Ndungani, and our engineer, Patrick Dea. I'm Jason Patinkin.
And I'm Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. Thank you for choosing the Voice of America.